Okay, we'll follow the same program as usual. Talk for 50 minutes or so. Short break in silence. And then a period of meditation before tea. So, let's get straight into it. Tonight I'm going to be talking about the ninth precept, really, which is the precept to undertake to change hatred into compassion. So that's the concern today, looking at changing hatred into compassion. Now, we've been talking about the purifying of our minds, the purifying and transcending our attachment to me and mine. We've seen that we are the heirs of 13 point, whatever it is, I've forgotten, 13 and a bit billion years of evolution. And this, reflecting on this, well, the reason I mention this every week is reflecting on it, I think, makes us realise how precious this human life is. It's something that's evolved over such a vast period of time, and we've actually got one. We've got it. And we have it for a very short time, just a flash. But we could do so much with it while we've got it. So that is well worth reflecting upon. Tibetans do this sort of thing every day. When they start their day, they reflect on the preciousness of the human body and the opportunities that it presents to them. So what are those opportunities? The opportunity is that we can push the envelope of evolution on further. We have a self-consciousness which has evolved from simple consciousness and so on. We can push that self-consciousness on. We can push on the depth of our experience of ourselves in the world, and we can make that experience much more positive. This is what's referred to in the Buddhist tradition as the karma niyama, the evolutionary process that goes on within the self, creating a self and creating the world in which we live. But we can go also beyond that into the Dharma Niyama, into something which is a new level, a new dimension of evolution, which we don't normally have that much experience of. And all of this really centres around this process of attenuating the experience of me and my world, attenuating that sense of self, that experience of self. So the purification of mind, the attenuation of attachment to a fixed self, is a progressive process. It is an evolution. It's not something that happens instantaneously. It's something that we continue to work on. The abandonment of attachment to me and mine, even if only for a moment, introduces or leaves a gap, as it were, for some influence that comes outside of that duality completely. It seems as though it comes from another dimension. And then as we start to come under the influence of that power, of that force, another evolutionary process starts, which is what in Buddhism we call the Dharma Niyama. I'd just like to say a couple of things about the emergence of the Dharma Niyama. It doesn't mean the elimination of the karma niyama. It doesn't mean to say that in order to transcend the self, we completely get rid of the self. It's worth noting that the Buddha himself could use the word I. He could say, you know, I would like to go to Rajgriha, or this is my teaching. So we have a being here who is recognised as having transcended self-consciousness, is still using those sort of terms, is still experiencing himself to some degree as a self in a world. So this is an important thing to bear in mind. It has a number of consequences. Let's just think in terms of the whole evolutionary process, actually. When matter came into being, space and time didn't disappear. although matter arose out of space and time. When living beings arose out of matter, the matter, material stuff, was still there. So the living beings was an additional dimension added to, inert matter. And then simple consciousness arose in living beings. So the living being continued, but something additional was added onto it, this simple consciousness, awareness of the environment. And then self-consciousness was added on to that simple consciousness, another dimension coming forth. And similarly, the enlightened consciousness, the Dharmanyama, is another dimension that adds on to what is already there. It's not that it gets rid of it. So this idea that in Buddhism we're trying to get rid of the self, we're trying to deny a self, is just incorrect. What we're trying to do is give up our attachment to the self to transcend it, not get rid of it. Another important point I thought I would mention is that according to the Buddha, consciousness does not exist. Consciousness exists because of the senses, although they might be subtle senses. So in order to be conscious, we've got to be conscious of something. There has to be an object to that consciousness. This means that consciousness does not exist without a material basis. There is a sutta where the Buddha says to some monk that he has a pernicious view, because he says that consciousness exists without a material basis. The Buddha says, no, that's not so. That consciousness arises in dependence upon contact. Contact has to come through a material, albeit it could be a subtle material form. So this is also worth pondering on. You know, this idea that your consciousness, as it were, leaves your body and goes on to another life is just not Buddhist. It might be part of the Tibetan tradition, but it's not part of basic Buddhist ideas. Worth reflecting on. Devas, by the way, the gods, are a bit more like angels than gods. Devas have bodies, although they can be very subtle bodies. They're not quite as constrained as our bodies are. Anyway, that's a bit of a divergence. So last week we looked at how the self is supported, how self-consciousness is supported by craving and attachment. We have attachment to people and we have attachment to things. We have attachment to ideas. We have attachment to views about ourselves. We have attachment to our reputations and we have attachment to our status. All of these things help to support and strengthen a sense of self. The more we can attenuate these attachments, the more we can minimize them, let the intensity decay, then the more free we become, the more we experience freedom. The opposite to craving is freedom, is liberation. So renunciation leads to liberation, it leads to freedom. Now we've seen that the general emotional tendency in support of our self-cherishing and our self-view is either to grasp, to crave, to be attached, or it's to push away, to reject. So we've talked about grasping, and now today I want to go on and talk about pushing away. Now the word Buddhism uses for this is hatred, vyapada and pratigha. These are very strong words, extremely strong words. Hatred is a good translation of them. So why is it such a strong word? Craving is a strong word as well, actually, for grasping. But we use a strong word to indicate that it's a very deep-rooted, it's a deep-seated emotion, and that it can become very, very powerful. It can become very strong. And what it does is it creates a separation between ourself and others. it pushes things apart. Usually it's people. Usually we're pushing people away. But sometimes it can be poor defenseless objects. You know, like the time you kick that thing that doesn't work. Through no fault of its own, really. It's just you push it out. You create a distinction between yourself and that object by pushing it away. Now, hatred, this rejection, can be of two types. It can be a reaction to a painful vedana, a painful feeling that we have. So we experience something painful, we react by trying to push away the object that we think caused that pain. It's a defensive act. But also, and much worse, there is a form of harming other people which helps support our sense of self. And I'll come back to that a little later on. So initially, I want to look at the form of hatred, which is a reaction to painful vedana. The word for this is pratika, which means enmity or anger or hatred. Other words that you come across are vyapada and vesha. So they all mean roughly the same kind of thing. They all mean roughly hatred. And this is the general term. As I say, its characteristic is to push away, either physically or emotionally. And we're pushing away something that's caused us suffering, or what we think will cause us suffering. We may even want to retaliate, to punish, so as to restore our ego security. It covers a whole range of intensities, from simply ignoring someone, simply just turning away from someone because of a dislike or, you know, something unpleasant about them. You turn away from crossing over the road so you don't have to talk to somebody. This is hatred, obviously in a pretty mild form. But it can also be actually killing someone, actually killing them to get them out of the way. For example, it might be that we don't like how somebody looks, just for some peculiarity, you know, something about them we don't really like. Maybe we don't like the way they speak. There's a chap that an announcer on Radio 4 whose voice I just do not like. It jars against me for some unknown reason, and I hate him. You know, I've been thinking of writing to the BBC saying, you must get rid of this man, you know, it's going to put people off radio for life. He's sort of, very unreasonable things. Maybe we just don't like someone's vibe, you know, they're just going to feel a bit sort of negative. And we don't like it, it's unpleasant to us. So we feel some kind of pain, some kind of dislike, some sort of unpleasantness, and so we ignore them. We often rationalise that emotion. Samnya comes into play, and we come up with reasons why that person is so unlikable. I have my reasons for the radio announcer, which I'm sure are perfectly correct. You know, so you come up with these, and then those reasons support one's emotional attitude. So Samnya and Chetana work together to provide a kind of firm basis for this rejection. On the other end of the scale, supposing someone has raped, tortured, and killed our daughter. The pain of that is absolutely unbearable, and we want that person killed. You know, we've been hearing about this on the radio recently from India and South Africa, and I'm sure it happens in many other places. The response of a parent is to want that perpetrator killed. And they have their reasons for it. And those reasons are, we might say, perfectly good. They're perfectly understandable. So hatred covers this whole range of emotional response to an unpleasant feeling. unpleasant or very highly painful feeling. Generally speaking, let's bring our minds back to the to my complaint about the radio announcer rather than the rather heavy-handed rape case. Hatred is a willing distortion that exaggerates the painful or bad qualities of that other person. So there's a willfulness there that that holds on to the rationalised, the perceived painful or bad qualities of that person or object. And we ignore anything that might be good or pleasurable about it. As in the case of craving, craving was where we emphasised the desirable qualities and rejected the undesirable qualities. This is the opposite. We're focusing on the painful qualities and rejecting any more positive ones that might be there. The other thing about hatred is that it disturbs mind and body and is itself painful. Craving can at least have a certain kind of pleasure to it. Falling in love is actually the uprising of craving, but we can be fooled into thinking that this is a very pleasurable experience. Not so with hatred. Hatred is always painful. We always experience it as painful. So we're adding pain onto already existent pain. This should be an incentive, an additional incentive, to help us get rid of hatred. But unfortunately, it doesn't always seem to be the case. So I'm next going to look at four different aspects, intensities in a way, of hatred. The first is krodha. You needn't remember these Sanskrit terms, but as I said some time ago, it is worth learning them, because they sometimes don't have exact correspondences in English. I think with all of these mental states that I'm talking about, the value for me is has been reflecting on them, going back over them again and again and again, and trying to understand what they really are from my own experience, recognising them within myself, because that then gives me kind of firm material to work with in my spiritual work. So krodha is fury, rage, belligerence, right? It's when that hatred is actually becoming physical. It's actually moved into one's body and you're quivering with it, you know. That is krodha. It actually is often referred to as taking up the stick. Yeah? So you're actually about to physically harm another being. It's to kick the offending object. And it also includes what the Pali Canon refers to as verbal daggers. Yeah? The monks are often accused of treating each other badly and attacking each other with verbal daggers. So it can be verbal as well as physical. It's getting ready to sort of really be abusive to somebody else. Somewhat less intensely, we've got pradasa. Now this means spitefulness, defensiveness, or irritability. It's also kind of touchiness. It's oversensitiveness. It's a sort of brushing away an object that's causing pain. I think the classic example of this is the mosquito. You're sitting there with your bathing costume on or some shorts or something, a mosquito comes on your leg, bites you. Hit it. Don't even think about it. Now that, in a way, is a relatively mild, but for the mosquito, very important expression of this sort of spitefulness. You'll kill it just because it's hurting you a little bit. It's defensive. You're protecting yourself. It's irritable, getting rid of it. So we can take the mosquito, if you like, as the model, as the paradigm of this particular emotional state. So not hitting mosquitoes is a very good practice against this mental state. Just sitting there, and letting her, it's always a female, by the way, which I think is perhaps meaningful, let her have her fill of your blood. Don't swipe out at her. Just let her do her business. Actually, it will cause you far less harm if you do that, because you don't get the swelling. You don't get the injection of the poison. And I've tried this at Gihiloko, where there's a few mosquitoes, and it's worked. I have not succeeded in doing it in New Hampshire, where the mosquitoes come at you in hordes. And there, you just slaughter them, I'm afraid. So, but that is a practice. So you can do that with mosquitoes. And you can do it with your children as well. Yeah. If your children get irritated, don't hit them. Don't swipe at them. You know, just not even verbally. Just sort of take it. If they're uncooperative, fine. If they're hitting you, fine. You just sort of try and live with it. So, yeah, it's this state of being easily offended, easily hurt, but able to snap back like a bulldog. One's always defending oneself from a supposed criticiser. For an example, one of the things I notice is that if I get in a conversation with somebody who's not vegetarian, and it happens that I reveal the fact that I'm a vegetarian, quite often they'll say, "Oh, that's for health reasons, is it?" I say, "No, it's for ethical reasons. I don't like killing animals and eating them." And quite often people will then go into a very defensive mode. They'll sort of, they have all sorts of excuses as to why they can't be vegetarian. I mean, in a way, it's not none of my business whether they're vegetarian or not. But they'll try and sort of rationalise why they're not vegetarian. Or even, they'll actually maybe attack me for being vegetarian. You know, saying it's unnatural, or, you know, I don't support the farmers of the southern states of America or something like that. So it's sort of, I mean, you get this in the States, actually. Not eating beef is a kind of, is a traitorous thing to do. So, yes, it's that kind of defensiveness to something which touches us and begins to hurt us. If this mental state really dominates us in our lives, it means that we have a kind of a stream of consciousness that's continually looking out for things to snap at, to sort of to have a go at. So it's, if it gets hold of you, it can be exceedingly painful, both for yourself and for those around you. One of the places where you can see this, I think most of us can see this, is after meditation. You know, you've had a lovely meditation, you've been quite content, you've sort of been blissed out, you know, loving the whole universe and so on. And then you walk out of the meditation into the other room and someone does something and you are absolutely furious. Or at least really annoyed that they've done that, whatever it is that they've done. So there it is. There's irritation, spitefulness arising out of what was previously a very positive mental state. Okay, ready for another one? The next one is irsya, or envy. Envy. Now, this is a rejection of others, separation of oneself from others because of their possessions or qualities, because one's envious of their possessions or qualities. Again, it can be material things, it can be wealth, it can because they've got more friends, you know, everybody seems to like them, whereas, you know, nobody likes me. It can be their success, it can be their reputation, it can be the honour that they receive. So any of these things can evoke in us a sense of envy and a sort of a desire in a way to get at that person because of it. It can be individual people, Or it can be whole groups of people. It can be whole nations, whole countries. I think probably, you know, we Brits tend to be a bit envious about Americans, you know, and we kind of like it when they do stupid things, because it sort of somehow gives us a sense of security. And maybe I'm just talking for myself here. But you know, that's the sort of thing. It's when you see somebody being criticised for something or having done something, someone you envy being put down in some way, you're actually pleased about it. You like that. The classic example that I thought of this, of course, is Iago in Othello. There, Iago is jealous of Othello, and what does he do? He doesn't say anything to Othello at all. He doesn't sort of face him or admit, they're meant to be friends, but he doesn't admit his jealousy. He just goes around poisoning everybody's mind against Desdemona, including Othello's mind, to the extent if Othello eventually kills her. So he poisons the mind of the person that he's jealous of, envious of. It's an exceedingly unpleasant emotion. Very painful to experience, but also very painful to admit, because it really does seem a low emotion. But to do so is actually incredibly liberating. It's really freeing to be able to do that. This is where confession comes in, and it's so important. One of my main areas of envy is if my friends, other people in the order, are praised for the quality of their talks or the value of their study groups or their ability as meditation teachers or of their energy or vitality. One very good friend of mine, who I won't name, but he's just written 5 very good booklets. Whenever anybody says to me, oh, how fantastic is he, how brilliant is he, I always, always cringe. It always happens. I admit it. Yeah? And I really work hard and say, well, yeah, it's great things he's done, you know. But before, in the past, I must admit, I would have done, said, well, yeah, okay, but, you know, I really don't like his style, or I really don't like this, that, or the other about what he does, or you've got to take this, that, or the other into account. So undermining it, poisoning the attitude. Another one? One more. And this is Upanaha. Upanaha. Even sounds horrible. They all sound pretty horrible, don't they, actually? Krodha, Pradasa, Irsha, Upanada, Upanaha. This means resentment. So in this particular case, the hatred is nursed. We experience rejection, a hatred of someone, but we nurse it. We keep it to ourselves. We blame, someone does something that hurts us, and we blame them for it. And we don't just go to them, we don't challenge them particularly, we just sort of keep it, we nurse it. We bear the grudge. We play the injury over again and again and again. We allow it to fester. We support it. We come up with all sorts of sanya, all sorts of rationalizations as to why that person is to blame, you know, how awful they were to do it. We try and get other people on our side. There's a whole kind of complex mechanism that goes with this. And supporting our position can get very, very complex. There was someone once who accused me of doing something which I didn't do. I actually didn't do it. But he was very angry with me for it. And that anger has gone on now for 25 years. And it's still not resolved. And it's got very, very complicated, very, very convoluted, and the whole procedure. So it's impossible now to work out sort of what was going on. But it's created a rift between myself and someone who, you know, was a good friend, is a good friend, really. We support it with very complex stories. And there's also this very strong feeling that we shouldn't actually let them off the hook. Yeah. Eventually, these little hurts and things, they've got to be let go. We've got to forgive people. But we don't want to do it because we feel it's wrong, as it were, to let them off the hook. We need to hold on to it. This is very destructive. And as I say, these things can go on for a very, very long time. They can colour one's whole experience of life. It really is a poison that sort of sinks deep into one's being. So, we need to counteract all of this. And there is a mental state, there's one mental state really, that is a general term for the counteraction to this, and this is advaisha. Advaisha is the prefix a onto the word dvesha, which means hatred. So it's not, a means not, so it's not hatred. But this, as I said the other week, this prefix a isn't just a negative, it also means it brings in another dimension. And the example I gave was like our word infinite, the prefix in front of finite. Doesn't just mean only that it's not finite. Infinite is something else. It's another dimension. So advesha is more than just an absence of hatred. It's something else. It's something very positive. And that positive is metta. That positive is universal, unconditional loving kindness. So let's just reflect a little bit on each of these words. So it's unconditional. An unconditional love, as has been said in a slightly different context, I must admit. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is an ever fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. So it's an unshakable, unconditional love. We don't give our metta under certain conditions. It just gives, it just comes. And in a way, it's something that we do, it's something we put our will behind, but it just flows out. It flows to wherever it happens to land. So it's unconditional loving. This is the love that is compared in the texts to the love of a mother for her only child. Intense. There's an intensity to it. There's a passion. There's something sort of just very, very powerful, very deeply emotional in that love. But it's not just for that child. It doesn't have an object in a way, because it will go to whoever happens to come within its focus. It's kindness. It's loving kindness. So it's made up of actions. It's not just feeling. That feeling drives actions, activity. Now, it's not always necessary, it's not always possible, at least in my experience, to feel love for everybody. But you can always be kind to people. There's no reason why one shouldn't act kindly. So even if there's a lot of personal resistance to acting kindly, you can still do it. They can still make that action. And then the love, as it were, will come along later. And finally, it's unconditional loving kindness for the benefit of all sentient beings. Now, this means any particular being that comes into our field of view. It's not the sort of universal love that cares for all humanity, but ignores those close at hand. I was trying to think, there's a character in Dickens, someone who's like this, who loves the whole of humanity, but you know, treats the people around them absolutely atrociously. So it's not that. It's like an inner beam, you know, that sort of is swinging around, and as soon as it hits on somebody, well then the love just goes to that person. I remember in the early days of my involvement with the movement, noticing about Sangharakshita. Whenever I was with Sangharakshita, I felt really loved. You know, I felt really that this man liked me, he was kind to me, and I thought, oh, that's great. But then I realised that he was like that with everybody. And actually, I felt really jealous. I felt put out by it. You know, that, I'm not special then. And the answer is, of course, I'm not special. Because his loving kindness would go to whoever happened to be with him. And it was of the same intensity, no matter who it was. So that's what it is. It's a creative act. It's something that comes from oneself and engages with other people. It's not dependent upon whether we like them or not, or whether they're a friend of ours or not, or anything. It just happens spontaneously. Well, not spontaneously. It needs a bit of effort. So this metta is a positive engagement with life. It's an acceptance of things, and especially people, as they are, without needing to change them for our own benefit. Although we may want to change them for their benefit. Yeah, that is a possibility. It's also an acceptance of the fact of dukkha. The fact that we cannot have a painless existence. Pain is a fact of life. It's one of the things that we get and we have to deal with. There's a lot of pleasure in existence, and we should embrace that pleasure. We should enjoy those things that we can enjoy. But we've also need to develop the strength to bear painful feelings when they do unavoidably arise. So, advesha, metta, involves a will to change the way that we perceive the world. It needs a different kind of samnya, a different rationalization to support this. We've got to shift the kind of rationalization that says, I am hurt, therefore I must reject, to I am hurt, therefore I hurt. Something like that, yeah? So that there isn't the sweeping out, the slapping of the mosquito doesn't happen. We still get the pain of the bite, but we learn to deal with that. So let's look at each of these kleshas, these unskillful events, and see briefly how we can deal with them. Rage, taking the stick. How do we deal with that? We just stop it. There's no other way to deal with it. We just stop it. Yeah. It's inexcusable behaviour for a Buddhist. There is absolutely no excuse for doing it. Of course we're going to do it, but we can confess it. That's what you have to do. Confess the unskillful things. Buddhists don't do that. To the extent that one's doing it, one is not a Buddhist. Therefore, quickly confess, then you can become a Buddhist again. There is no such thing as righteous indignation in Buddhism. We all probably know the story of the two-handed sword. The Buddha said that if you are captured by highwaymen who are robbers, and they cut you apart limb from limb with a two-handed sword, if there's any feeling of enmity towards those robbers, then you're not a disciple of mine. Yeah. Now, this is a pretty tall order. Okay, you can say this is very idealistic. Well, it is idealistic. That is the ideal. That's the thing to which we're aspiring. We will fail. But as long as we confess, dust ourselves down and start all over again, then we're acting as effective Buddhists. Because of this, of course, there's no such thing as blasphemy in Buddhism. Buddhists should not be offended by anything offensive said about their religion. They might feel the pain of it, but they wouldn't claim that they have a right to retaliate because it's a blasphemy. Oh, that other religions had no blasphemy. Okay, let's look at pradasa, irritability, defensiveness, spitefulness. So why do we swipe the mosquito? Well, it's because she's caused us pain. Yeah? Ipso facto, she's caused us pain, she deserves to be swiped. But is she in the wrong? All a mosquito's doing by biting you is getting some food for her kids. Yeah? Good thing for a mother to do. Kids to be, actually. Good thing for a mother to do. So, is she doing wrong? Has she actually been unskillful? Is my pain the measure of right and wrong? These are the sort of questions we need to ask ourselves. And even if he or she has been unskillful, like the robbers, are we right to respond unskillfully? Are we right to add unskillfulness to unskillfulness? According to the Buddha, we aren't. We should learn to withstand those things. We have to face up to the fact that people are like they are. We cannot change them into something more acceptable to ourselves. We can, of course, as I said, encourage them to change for their own benefit. But we just have to accept them. And this means transforming our perception of them. So they might be kind of grumpy and irritable. But if we don't take it personally, we can still love them. In fact, we can feel quite an affection towards someone who's a bit of a grump, even though it's not, you know, exactly what we'd like them to be. They may be super critical, but we could appreciate, well, they often do actually have a point. You know, they have got a perspective. I remember Banti once saying to me, he says, it's always good to know what people think of you. They might be wrong, but it's always good to know what they think of you. And I really agree with that. They may do something that's actually hurtful to us. But as Shantideva said, well, they took the stick, but we took the body. So we have some responsibility in that action. This is a seriously advanced bodhisattva practice. Yeah, it's not easy. But again, you know, ideals are good. Trying to live up to ideals is good. Again, we'll fail, but never mind. We keep trying to live up to those ideals. So this is the essence of universal loving, unconditional loving kindness. It's a very tall order, but it's something that we have to take seriously if we're going to call ourselves disciples of the Buddha. We need to develop upeksha. Upeksha is one of the Brahma Viharas, one of the living places of the gods. And upeksha is equanimity. Equanimity in the face of suffering. We have to learn to accept suffering. Not put ourselves into situations where we will suffer. No beating. Beating not allowed in Buddhism. But if we find ourselves in situations where we do suffer, then we have to learn to bear it. It's worth noting that upeksha is associated with mindfulness. And this is necessary, because in order to catch these irritable actions, we need mindfulness. We've got to get in there quickly before we squish the mosquito. And as I said, the upeksha is also Brahma Vihara. It's one of the dwelling places of the very highest gods of form. So it's a very elevated state. If we can achieve this state of upeksha, then we've indeed have achieved a very elevated spiritual state indeed. Envy. How do we deal with this? Well, I've already suggested confession is particularly effective, I have found. And believe me, I have had to practice this. So confessing to a friend, telling them that you're envious, not necessarily the person you're envious of. It might, you know, you needn't be that person. It could be somebody else. Tell them what kind of state you're in. And then practice mudita. Actually, look for things to praise in that person and go out of your way to do so publicly. Yeah. At first, it's very difficult, but it becomes easier, and gradually one starts to realise that one's envy is going away, and it all seems rather silly and pathetic, and then it just sort of starts to drop off. Gratitude is also a good general antidote. Regular expressions of gratitude enables us to experience what we've received from others. You know, whenever we've received something, express that gratitude. It creates a good atmosphere, because if gratitude's going around, but also it makes one conscious that one has received from others. And this tends to undermine one's experience of envy. Okay, moving on. Upanaha, resentment. Resentment relies on forgiveness. This is really what we have to do. Forgiveness is a form of renunciation. It's letting go of that pain, letting go of our accusations of that person. It's a strong form of spiritual practice, a very powerful form of spiritual practice, because it's a combination of renunciation, of letting go of something, and also in that letting go, there will arise a much more positive feeling towards that that person. It's a relief. Forgiveness is a relief, and forgiveness is actually a pleasure. To forgive, you quite often find that people, when they forgive someone else, they burst into tears. Okay, they're tears of pleasure because the relief of that tension is gone. Lots of forgiveness we need. So we can use these practices to start to transform our natural reaction to protect ourselves into a less self-centered, self-cherishing state of loving-kindness. However, there's another way in which we support the self by hurting others, which is in a way much, much more serious. And this is in Sanskrit, vihimsa. Vihimsa means cruelty. Vi is an intensifier. Himsa is harm. So this is the desire to inflict intense harm on another being. And it's listed separately from hatred. Hatred is a reaction to being hurt. So it's a reaction to one's own suffering. But vihimsa is different from this. It's actually the desire to hurt. It's the desire to cause suffering to another being. Now, why on earth should we do this? Why should anyone want to do that? I'd like to suggest that to cause another pain is going against their will. Nobody wants to experience pain. So to inflict pain upon somebody else is to go against their will. To go against somebody else's will means that you must have an intensity of will yourself to do that. You know, if you're hurting someone and they're experiencing pain, they're complaining about it, in order to continue doing that, you're having to strengthen yourself. You strengthen your own will. Strengthen your separation from that person in order to be able to do it. So I think that cruelty is an expression of one's will to a very high degree, and therefore it's a confirmation of oneself. So you feel yourself, you feel your self-consciousness through the act of cruelty. Now this then, therefore, is pure self-assertion. It's a mental state, therefore, that's in complete opposition to the whole of the spiritual life, the whole of the spiritual project. So vihimsa is the most anti-spiritual mental event that there is. It's the absolute worst of all unskillful mental events. It needs, therefore, to be taken really seriously. Now, we may not engage in physical cruelty, but it can appear in our minds, in fantasy. And even the most horrific things are not beyond our imagination. This, again, this is a bit of a confession, but this was struck home to me once when, 20 years ago, I was driving along in the States, and as I was driving along the road one way, there was a young woman, hitchhiking, going in the opposite direction. And I was just driving along, and all of a sudden I realised that I'd had this fantasy about picking her up, taking her somewhere, tying her up and raping her. And it wasn't out of sexual desire. There was something else at work. I was stunned with myself for having had that fantasy. I didn't believe that I could have even thought that. But I did. Not only that, I could feel the energy of it. You know, I could feel the excitement of it. And it was purely an act of cruel violence in order to give me a sort of sense of self. And it crept in on me like that. Now, sometimes you can find in meditation, you can develop fantasies spontaneously arising that are very cruel. One of my friends has got what he calls the machine gun fantasy. He just, you know, he goes into supermarkets and mows everybody down with a machine gun. And he says it just suddenly arises. He used to be in the army, maybe that had something to do with it. So, you know, watch out for these fantasies, because they are dangerous. What struck me, having read this morning about the BAFTAs last night, is that action films provoke this kind of mental event. They stimulate it. I think the enjoyment that people get from action films is that you know, they're identifying with the hero of the film. So they're getting we get a sense of intensified self through those experiences. It really shocked me in a way that Skyfall won, what's it, best film? I don't know if you know this film, it's the James Bond film. I mean, I went to see it and it's just like people blowing people up all the time. If you identify with the perpetrator of that, it's sort of, there's an excitement there. But what it is, it's strengthening the self. It's actually a kind of magic that it's evoking vihimsa. Also, last night, Tarantino's, was it Django Unchained, was voted best screenplay. Utterly violent. And Tarantino is absolutely clear that he makes violent films so that he can make money. You know, there's no ethical dimension to it. So he knows that these films can evoke this same kind of, evoke vihimsa, and thereby strengthen a sense of self, and therefore become popular. So I think action films are awful. And they're really kind of a sign of the values of our society, which is really quite frightening. Films are magic, and one should beware of magic. Magic is the evocation of mental states. Even talking about them, as we have done tonight, is dangerous. We evoke the demons. As I was preparing these talks, actually, I had quite a few dreams that were very unpleasant. And I think it was because of these, you know, these negative mental states being evoked. Now, today's magicians don't stand on the crossroads. In the Buddha's time, they used to stand on the crossroads and make elephants appear, things like that. But nowadays, they work in the entertainment business. They work in the advertising industry. They work in the media. So they're out there and they're very strong. Negative mental states are being evoked all the time in our lives. So we've got quite a lot of work to work against them. We've got to take them seriously as well. They're undermining our opportunity for happy existence and enlightenment. That's a pretty serious thing. A milder form of vihimsa is malice. And malice is quite often expressed verbally. So vihimsa with the tongue is actually probably not unknown to many of us, at least once or twice in our lives. We counteract this tendency with avihimsa. Avihimsa is the complete and absolute desire to harm another living being. The thought of causing harm to another being is actually repulsive. It's painful. So it's avoided. It's a spontaneous desire, avihimsa, is a spontaneous desire to take away suffering from another. And it's almost a kind of total empathy with other people. And this is the real nature of compassion. And compassion is the most spiritual of all mental events, the very best of all mental events. So we can see that vihimsa and avihimsa are the very worst and the very best of all mental events. In avihimsa, there is a direct attempt to negate the self. Although in the karma niyama, there is a self that's driving it. We are using the self, as it were, to overcome the self. In all the lists of mental estates, avihimsa is the last to be described, because in a way it's the last mental state before one moves on into a transcendent level. So how do we overcome the self? How do we practice, as it were, avihimsa? How do we evoke avihimsa in our lives? On the ordinary level, it's looking after other people, caring for other people, benefiting others, working in healthcare or healthcare research, doing social work, all sorts of things that help people directly. Even, I would say, building roads and houses, if it's a vocation. You know, people who engage in those kind of activities are doing something for the benefit of others. Particularly if they're doing it with that in mind, then it becomes a negation of oneself. Also, it's a giving up one's own needs for the needs of another. There's a classic example of this, which I'm sure you know of, the Gosinga Sutta. The Gosinga Sutta outlines the ideal Buddhist community. Three monks are living a very simple life in the forest, dedicated to spiritual practice, and the Buddha visits them. And he asks them how they're managing to live in harmony, like milk and water. And one of them, Aniruddha, says that the way that he lives in harmony is by maintaining acts of loving kindness in body, speech and mind, in public and in private, towards his fellows. In other words, he counteracts all of those, all senses of hatred by practicing metta. And he also says, I think, why should I not put aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones would do? And then I put aside what I would do and do what these venerable ones would wish to do. So this is a complete practice of renunciation of self, putting others entirely before oneself. Now in this particular example, the others are engaged in the spiritual life very seriously. And so all the difficult questions about when should one and when should one not give over to another person are avoided. Do you see what I mean? Like if you can't take on that practice of doing what he would do, putting aside what I would do and doing what he would do in the general course of ordinary life, I mean, you'd be totally walked on, totally abused probably. So there are questions about when or when one can't practice that. In everyday life, there's a compromise with the spiritual life. We can't live like that because other people are not doing that. So we have to compromise our activity. This is why it's so important to create special conditions under which we can actually seriously practice like this. So by developing communities, by going on retreat, by developing, you know, having our centres, we can actually start to practice this idea of putting aside what I would do and do what he or she would do instead. So under those circumstances, we need places where we can uncompromisingly practice in this way. Okay, just to sum up, the importance of kindness. Abandoning craving reveals true freedom and happiness. Abandoning hatred opens the heart to loving kindness and compassion. And this is what the Buddha teaches. In some places he said that this is all he teaches. Some people fear that if we diminish or abandon our attachment to others, we will become cold and uninterested. But this is clearly not the case. A new level of disinterested but very positive emotion gradually evolves. And this provides a transformation on the basis of which we can relate to other people. So mundane affection, pema, which has a degree of self-interest, is gradually transformed. It gradually evolves into a genuine feeling of universal loving kindness, which is directed towards all who come within our orbit. In fact, since our relationships with others are becoming less and less deluded by our own fictions that we're laying on them, the relationships actually become more real. They become more satisfying, and they're based on a genuine selfless concern. So the discussion we've been having gives a clue as to why liberation and compassion are so intimately bound together. Freeing ourselves from bondage to the self is also freeing ourselves to see others as they really are, and our empathy with them will give rise to compassion for their suffering. And this arises spontaneously. And so it's of a different quality to the compassion that comes from our self-will. Self-willed compassion, of course, is very important to help overcome the self, but there will come a point when compassion arises spontaneously. And this is the distinction in the Buddhist tradition between karuna, compassion, and mahakaruna, the great compassion, which is part of the Dhamma Niyama. So we'll be talking more about that when we've considered banishing the self itself, and banishing self-cherishing by working on it very directly. And that's going to be the subject for next week. Okay. So let's take 5-10 minutes break, and then we'll have a half an hour meditation, very similar to the ones we've been doing so far.